Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone.
So, yeah, it's been a busy week in Syracuse-related things. It's been a busy week in other orange and blue-related things.
Islanders hockey is back.
Catch the rush. Islanders hockey at Barclays Arena.
If you Boise State Broncos football, not so back.
Now, we're, of course, alluding to the New York Mets, who pulled off what seemed impossible just weeks ago. And for most people who've ever watched baseball, for most of the last 20 years, impossible. But not only did the Mets make the World Series, but they managed to sweep the Chicago Cubs. Day of 95 wins and a bunch of home run hitters in very impressive fashion. We will not talk about this for more than 5 minutes, I swear. But Dan, your initial reactions?
I still haven't totally emotionally processed it. I think if this series had been a little more of a struggle, I would have, you know, felt probably a little more... you know, normally about Mets achievements, which are shocking and wonderful for me. But like the Dodger series was, you know, a pretty back and forth one. I didn't think we were going to pull it out in the end, and we did. The Cubs series was just total domination from the jump, which was not expected with that lineup they have. So it was bizarre. It was bizarre to see the Mets just go in and absolutely ruin a team for four straight games. Like none of the games ever like really felt all that much in doubt by the end. So not used to that at all.
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked about it a lot, and it's just it's such a weird. Even when the Mets are good, they just never make it easy. I mean, and that goes all the way back, you know, to '69. Like it just never, it's never been easy for that team, and this year was. The regular season wasn't easy, but the playoffs, you know, the Dodgers series, I was pretty convinced early on that the Mets were going to win based on pitching alone. I told you as soon as, you know, the Mets tagged either Greinke or Kershaw for a loss, that was it. That ended up working out. And then obviously, you know, Mets pitching again, just while the final score might not indicate the Mets pitching is what brought them through. I mean, it's pretty clear that Mets pitching allowed the Cubs bats to take over that series the way they very well could have and sort of did against St. Louis.
Yeah, there was some stat heading in. I forget the exact number, but basically the Cubs, for all of their awesome young bats, were the worst team in baseball against like 95-mile-per-hour or above pitching. And every Mets starter in the playoff rotation throws at least 95. Syndergaard was hitting 101 on the regular against the Dodgers in that first start in L.A. You know, DeGrom hangs around 97 with his fastball. Harvey hangs around 97, 98. Mats is the slowest one. He's at, like, 95 pretty consistently. So when you have that kind of pitching every night and then you can hopefully get, like, 6 or 7 innings and bridge to Familia, who is... just since he added the split finger to his arsenal midseason has been pretty much unhittable. It makes things a lot easier. And then obviously Daniel Murphy is having a playoffs that no one else has ever had in history. So that helps.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I hit on the pitching and that's big. And I'm glad you brought that stat up because I honestly hadn't seen that, but it makes a lot of sense now why most of the balls we were seeing were fastballs. I think that, you know, with Murphy, I can't quantify it. I can't qualify it. There is no explanation for what's happening at this point. And I mean, that's fine. And that's also what makes teams do what the Mets just did to the Cubs, is that it creates this sort of, you know, fever almost amongst the rest of the team. That, you know, once Murphy is hitting the way he is, it's infectious. People want to make sure that they're on base for him. They want to make sure that they're driving him in if he's not hitting home runs. It was crazy to see, and it reminded me, for a little while at least, of the 2005 Carlos Beltran playoff run that he had. Obviously, Beltran does not hold the greatest place in Met fan memories. Though I would say he also gets a bad rap for that third strike looking back in the 2006 NLCS in Game 7. But his 2005 run with the Astros was at least at this point, one of the top 5 to 10 playoff performances by a hitter, at least in the expanded playoff era.
Yeah, and Murphy's numbers are better. Like, Murphy had a 1.8 OPS against the Cubs, which is just like, that shouldn't happen ever. No. And it's not a huge sample size, but at this point, it's ridiculous. He's at almost 1.5 for the entire playoffs, so he's now owns the streak for most home runs in a row in a playoff game, or most games with a home run. He's touching some like crazy Lou Gehrig streaks. Like, it's the whole thing is absurd, and especially coming from Murphy, who for Mets fans is an often really really good and a very often totally frustrating player. Power hitting is not usually his thing. It's not like he goes on power surges ever. He had never hit 5 home runs in a month before. Now he has 6 and 6 games and 7 in the playoffs. So yeah, it's pretty, like, these things happen in baseball, though. And sometimes, you know, when Beltran does it, who's a borderline Hall of Famer, you know, you can accept that. When Daniel Murphy, who's like a borderline, you know, if you get a better second baseman, you'd probably like to most of the time, and he's, you know, a little bit above replacement level, solid hitter, really awful fielder, not a very good base runner, despite the fact that he's made like 3 amazing base running plays in these playoffs alone. So just, he can't do any wrong, and the Mets are much better for it, and it might cost the Mets a chance to retain him for next year, but right now I think we're just riding the wave.
I would agree, and that's your Mets update for the week. There will be at least one game before the next podcast, so expect a little bit more of this next week, but I promise we're going to try to keep it in the 5-minute range or so, since there's plenty of fans who are Syracuse fans who are not Mets fans, plenty of Syracuse fans who just hate baseball, and yeah, I don't want to put those people out.
Yes, you can always skip ahead and just or just indulge me. That's fine.
Indulging is probably the better bet, but yeah, skip ahead.
We only get this like every 15 years. So.
All right. So the topic at hand for this podcast, most times, is Syracuse football. Last week sucked. Didn't suck as bad as the USF game in many ways, but in others it was worse. which is very, very, very unfortunate for us. Dan, what was the best and worst part for you of Syracuse's loss to Virginia in triple overtime?
I would say compared to the South Florida game, which seemed like a breakdown in preparation and, you know, a total, like, just the team just came out and flat. Against Virginia, it seemed like the game plan was mostly there, and the team played about as well as you'd expect until the fourth quarter, which is becoming a bit of an issue for SU. It definitely wasn't as bad as South Florida, because South Florida is probably a worse team, and Syracuse lost by 20. Losing to Virginia by a touchdown triple overtime, you know, on its face, when you're not a much better program, you can get over that. But just very disappointing to see a lot of the same mistakes happening over and over, the same coaching miscues. I know some people like are writing it off, but at the end of regulation, when Schaefer let Virginia just run the clock down to 2 seconds rather than forcing them to take a field goal with like 35 left, despite the fact that he had 3 timeouts. And, you know, maybe Dungy doesn't lead the team down the field in 30 seconds, but
why not let him try?
It's not the craziest thing in the world. It's not so far out of the realm of possibility that you don't give it a shot, especially when you have 3 timeouts and you're going to use one to ice the kicker anyway, which is kind of a nebulous thing. And it's a 25-yard field goal, so the odds of him missing it are very slim. So that, just stuff like that, drives me nuts. And then I'm not so annoyed by the not going for it for two. I probably would if given the choice, and looking at everything and looking at how the defense struggled down the stretch. But the 2-point conversion at the second overtime, where Dungy scored, I think on the first play, where he threw that awesome pass to Steve Ishmael in the corner. I think that was the second touchdown. Probably would go for two there. I can't totally kill the stat for not, but just overall, end of game management things, the defense wearing out, just getting repeatedly gashed by quick swing passes to the running back, which we knew was an issue from USF, and USF had more things to hurt us with, and Virginia just had the one and was able to continue to do it. So just some really frustrating things in a game that Syracuse looked like it had in hand for three quarters.
Yeah, the problem is, against UVA, I was never really convinced we were, like, even when we were up by 10 going into the fourth, I was never sitting there going, like, this game's over and done with, if only because the cracks started showing against, with this defense, late in the third, going into the fourth. I mean, yes, the defense needs to get off the field for the offense to run more plays, but the offense only ran 18 plays in the second half. They settled for a field goal on a long drive in the third quarter. The fourth quarter, you know, they had one drive in that quarter as well, and really, really didn't look like they were trying to do anything but, you know, run out some clock. And even then, it didn't work. I recapped the play calling for the first half of the season for Leicester, and you know what? There's a lot of good there. There's also some harbingers of maybe some bad things to come against better teams. Syracuse has not really racked up the yardage that one would think with a better offense. They've been more efficient. They've had less plays from scrimmage. While they're getting into the red zone more, they're still really not pushing it into the end zone as much as they should. And then we're seeing, you know, a skewed kind of bit of play calling toward the pass. Obviously, again, I'm including the you know, those pocket breakdown runs as passing play calls, because that's what they are. I think too much is being put on Dungy, and I think too much is being put on Dungy by the coaching staff afterward, too. I think that's something we can get into a little bit later. What I saw in the UVA game was a bit of a killer because of, you know, the two things. Well, the one you mentioned in particular, not calling that timeout, just annoyed me to no end. I mean, like you said, Dungy can score pretty quickly. After we got that turnover late in the second, he scored in one play. Yes, it was from closer, but you know, this is a team that can score quickly, especially with some timeouts. And then I know Sean was a little more bent and twisted than you or I were about the 2-point conversion try in the second overtime that probably should have happened. But I think hindsight's 20/20. Yes, the defense was getting shredded, but you can't necessarily assume, you know, that every single time. But I also think that this coaching staff has a tendency to put things on the defense instead of letting the offense win. And based on the current personnel and the way they've been performing this season, that might be a terrible idea. Dan, you're on mute.
Yeah, sorry. For some reason, my Skype doesn't like to let me unmute myself for seconds at a time. No, I totally agree. I think, especially when the defense had been showing cracks pretty much the entire fourth quarter, it wasn't like they had given up some big plays here and there. It was like once the fourth quarter hit, you know, whether it was fatigue or whatnot, it just, the defense was unable to make a stop. Virginia cut down the lead really quick. They had that really long sustained drive where they were just gashing us for yardage. So you would hope that the staff would recognize that, and instead of, you know, just leaning on the team identity or whatever of going with the defense, like, you have to make the best call based on what you're seeing on the field, whether or not that's admitting something's not working for one side of the ball or not. You can't just, like, lean back and throw up your arms and say, yeah, well, we put it on the defense, and the defense is what we're known for, because this year the offense is probably the better side of the ball, at least down the stretch. I trust them. I trust the offense to score more than I trust the defense to make a big stop against just about anyone late in games. So and like you said, the blaming Dungy stuff, it's you know, there has to be coaching done, and I totally understand that Dungy's not perfect, and we've said that, like, we've been very, you know, quick to tell people to not crazy when Dungy makes freshman mistakes, and he's still not making all that many. But I also don't really get why you have to remind everyone of that every time anything's asked in the press. I mean, I just don't know why the coaching staff can't just say, you know, he's a freshman, he's going to make some mistakes, but he's playing really well, and move on, rather than pinning every, like, particular thing he hasn't done well. It almost seems like when a coach is trying to get through to someone through the media, and unless we're missing something about Dungy's personality, it just doesn't seem like that's necessary. If it was, then I'd get it more. If it was, you know, if it was Johnny Manziel out there, who everyone knows what his, you know, MO is, that's fine. But Dungy seems like he's probably pretty receptive to coaching. So I don't know. Lester especially is definitely not all that media trained, for better or worse. And on occasion, we get a lot more out of him than any other coach on the team, which is nice. But sometimes he just kind of lets go what he's, you know, whatever's on his mind. And maybe that comes back and bites him, and maybe that's something he needs to work at, being a first-time offensive coordinator at this level. But it is a little strange that every week we do have to hear, you know, the exact gripes against Eric Dungy, despite the fact that he's been probably the best quarterback we've had in 4 years, even as a true freshman, and, you know, way better than anyone could have envisioned. So hopefully there is some kind of ulterior motive that is working there, but it is strange to see so consistently.
Yeah, and I think, like, this has become a bit of an issue for the staff. And, you know, if we were winning, you could probably brush it under the rug. But since we're not, it becomes much more difficult to take on a week-to-week basis. Like, again, obviously Dungy makes some mistakes here and there, but no, Dungy is not the reason we're losing games. Dungy's not the reason why blocking is breaking down. And, like, you know, it was very surprising to hear that from Rob Trudeau, to take a cue from his offensive coordinator and just start kind of piling on some criticism. Like, at the pro level, it doesn't work. You know, whether you're playing for the Colts and you're blocking for Andrew Luck, or you're playing for the freaking Jaguars and you're blocking for Blake Bortles, it doesn't matter. Any offensive lineman who's going to sit there and blame a quarterback for, you know, blocking breakdowns, that's a guy who's not going to last long. And, you know, Trudeau's a leader on this team. Trudeau's a very good offensive lineman. Trudeau probably has more pro potential right now than anybody else on the team. And it was surprising to see that. I don't want to hammer the kid too much. I just think that right now, him and if this thing continues to fall apart a little bit, I think you're going to start seeing it from more of the veterans. I think we're going to see more talking out against certain players, and I don't like it. If we're going to talk out about any certain players, like, why not identify a secondary that can't cover anything? How about, you know, linebackers who, well, they played better against Virginia than they did against USF, still really struggling coverage, and you could see the cracks showing. You know, this is, to me, it is mind-blowing that we're isolating certain players. It's always been, you know, for all the family atmosphere and the team-first stuff that Schaefer preaches, that there's an awful lot of finger-pointing going on. And to me, I won't say it's a reflection on him directly, but something in the culture of the team right now is creating just, again, things we don't see. Like, you don't see this on 0-6 teams, never mind 6-0 teams or 3-3 teams. Like, this doesn't happen at the collegiate level. Nobody sits around and points fingers. And it's weird that we're watching this happen. And it's even weirder that there's a portion of the fan base defending it.
Yeah, and it's you know, a lot of the same people that want to automatically appoint Dungy as the 4-year starter and the next straight series quarterback, and the guy we've been waiting for sits McNabb, and that's all fine because he does look the part. But then you think that he would also get a little bit of leeway from, you know, occasionally maybe not making the quickest read when he's a freshman. Like, that's something that comes along later, and also. So it's confusing that this is apparently such a point of contention that you're hearing it from the top offensive lineman and the offensive coordinator, you know, he is a freshman. He is coming out of, you know, he's not coming in from Texas where they all run the spread and all make the exact perfect read every time for 8 years of middle school and high school football. You'd think that if this is such a struggle for Dungy, which it's hard to tell or not because we don't know the precise play call on every play, you know, maybe you adjust and hold in an extra blocker to pick up the blitz occasionally just to give him a little more time or to make things a little easier on him. So they all need to figure that out. I know this seems to, you know, maybe it's something that's a little more frustrating for us than it is for others, but you would like to see a team that doesn't look like it's not great when a team is outwardly showing its seams to the media for, I don't know why. It doesn't really seem like there's much to gain from it. So hopefully everyone gets on the same page going forward and, you know, hope if they can pick up a win this week, I'm sure we'll all not mind whatever they say afterwards, as long as it's not too ridiculous, as long as no, you know, current events or civil conflicts are brought up.
Yeah, that I think that's my other worry. Like, if we're being so frank about the team itself, I'm very worried about our kind of as we creep into, you know, pig with laces and ISIS mentions territory. Like, I feel like Schaefer's moved on from that, but this isn't to overly criticize him. I actually really, really like the guy. I've met him, and I think that he is probably one of the nicest people I've ever met. But I think that, you know, nice doesn't always translate to wins, and sometimes, like, nice can sometimes result in people being a little too just, like, bristly to criticism. I think that we're seeing a little too much of that. Like, it's, you're going to get criticized if you're a D1 coach. You're going to get criticized if you're a Power 5 coach in particular. And when you're the only game in town and basically the pro team of a city, you're also going to get, like, a ton of, you know, criticism when things are bad. But at the same time, you're going to get praise when things are good. It seems pretty clear, based on Donnie Simmons' comments, that there's an enemy being painted up in the locker room, probably since the summer, and that enemy is the media. And, you know, it's very shocking, especially for a team that represents a school that is the number one journalism school in the country. You would think that, you know, anyone with a keyboard that went there probably has an opinion and is probably sharing it somewhere.
Yeah, it's silly. And the media, like, Syracuse's media is so much more fair than most major programs. I don't think anyone there has done anything to step out of line. Yet there really is this kind of contemptuous relationship coming mostly from the team. And I don't know if that's something that was kind of artificially put in place to rally someone or something. But it comes off as immature a lot of the time. It's totally, like, people are just trying to do their jobs. They're having media is good for you. Like, if they would allow the Stephen Baileys and Nate Minks of the world to share the positive stories from the team, they would put them in the paper. Like, it's not crazy. When you let them talk to the players and learn about the players and their personalities and their backgrounds, those stories go and get written, and everyone likes them, and they're easy to support, and you kind of gain some goodwill from it. Instead, we have this super frustrating, like, bunker mentality where, you know, one thing goes wrong, or, you know, even after the 3-0 start, we saw that whole press conference, which was a debacle. You know, something looks like it might not go right forever, and people are freaking out because, I don't know, they don't want people noticing. It's bizarre. And as someone who looks at a lot of college football teams, and not just Syracuse, a lot of teams have a similar relationship with their local media, but oftentimes that local media is actually hard on them, or you can kind of understand where it's coming from, or they are more relevant on a national scale, so they face more criticism. Syracuse doesn't really have any of those problems, so I struggle to understand the rationale for it.
No, I completely agree, and you know, without belaboring it, you know, I hope it changes. I know that there was that quote that came out after the Jackson State thing. For those who weren't paying attention, Jackson State's local newspaper said that they would no longer be covering the team in protest of not getting access, and Jackson State was fine with it, and they were like, great, that's actually what we wanted. And, you know, in kind of the aftermath of that, there was a quote that said, you know, 90% of positive stories in college sports go unreported because of a lack of access for media. And I think that, you know, I get behind that quote 100%. It just seems like there are all these cool stories and there's all these great... I mean, SU's football team has so many great stories, so many kids. Like, and that's the painful part here is that, like, Schaefer cares so much about these kids and these kids who, you know, whether it's Darrell Eskridge, like, or, you know, Hunt's background, like, all these kids who have these stories and, like, you can actually really, you know, empathize with them and get behind them and want to root for them. And right now you root for them collectively on the team, but you can root for these guys individually. And it's insane that more access isn't granted to allow these stories to come out there.
And we also have like a group where, you know, I don't think anyone's over the top in terms of being a homer like you do see in other towns, but like Brent roots for the team. Chris Tarleton's admitted he roots for the team. Bailey is a little more impartial, but he's a alum. Who knows with Bud? I don't know at all with Bud. But like, it's a group of people that are supportive of the team in one way or another. And as a media member, I can tell you things are easier. You get more traffic. You have more to write about. It's just a much easier culture when the team that you're covering is good. It's not even a debate. When things are bad, yes, you can get a slight bump and there are, you know, some stories that you can write, but overall, you will get more out of it if the team is good. So the local media is not rooting against Syracuse football. It's not hoping for Syracuse football to go 3-9 every year, because after a while that gets stale and people stop caring. The team, the newspaper would be doing better if the team is good every year. So the fact that people think there's like some kind of conspiracy is so patently false and absurd. It just makes my brain stream every time I see anyone say that Syracuse.com writers are out to get the team and are just trying to write clickbaity stories. No, they're not, because if the team was good, the paper would be doing better. They probably wouldn't have to lay off people all the time. It drives me nuts. So yes, if you actually think that there is some kind of brand conspiracy for Syracuse.com or anyone else or Nunes or whoever to want the team to not be good for traffic or page view or newspaper subscription purposes, you are an insane person, and I welcome you to tweet me your rebuttal, and I will call you out on Twitter for being stupid.
Yeah. Dan coming in with some not at all.
Coming in hot.
Coming in hot, but not with hot takes. These are yeah, it is Friday morning for both of us. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here. And the fact that I have enough energy to do this is very shocking. Yet here we are. On that note, go for a little halftime. We can get a drink in us to calm things down a little bit.
I might need to after that.
There it is.
Too much energy for 11:17.
All right, Dan, what have you been? What have you been drinking?
A lot of fallish stuff. Sierra Nevada's Oktoberfest has been pretty much a staple. Talked about that, I think, a couple times, so I won't go too much into it. I had Electric Peel, which is an American pale ale from Magic Hat. Didn't love it at first, but it kind of grew on me. Has some really interesting citrus notes, really drinkable. Had a couple of those watching one of the Mets games. Can't remember which one. I also tried Captain Lawrence, released a grapefruit IPA, kind of similar to the Ballast Point Stolpen. Not as good, but quite drinkable. I don't think it quite marries the grapefruit and the IPA as well as the Ballast Point does, but they're both very apparent. It just doesn't, I don't know, the flavors aren't quite blended as perfectly, but it's still very drinkable, very, very good. If you like grapefruit, it's quite grapefruity. And, you know, Captain Lawrence does really good work, so not really too surprised that it's a very solid drink. And then had Brooklyn Lager while watching the Mets clinch the World Series, which is, that was the only New York beer on tap where I was, which was weird, but Brooklyn Lager is always a solid choice. Nice, like, kind of caramel notes. Very drinkable. And some, that was after I had accidentally ordered Goose Island and hadn't realized what I was doing. So I had one of those and it didn't doom my team to failure. So that was good.
Yeah. I messed that up. What did I drink? Oh, I accidentally ordered a Belgian pale ale during the, USA Belgium game last year. And of course we know how that worked out. And I was just so, so angry.
You're the reason that Lukaku made that goal.
Yes, very much so. And things that I drank in the last week, I had Campfire Stout from High Water Brewing. And I mentioned this one last year and probably the year before as well. Really enjoyable stout. It's nice, crisp. It's got a very s'moresy kind of finish on it, which is very good. I'd highly recommend serving this one at somewhere in like the 50 to 55 degree range, versus like your typical 38 to 40. I just think in general, it allows all of those kind of dessert tones to come out. Hope that didn't sound too douchey, but chances are it did. I'd had a Noble Ale Works Galaxy Showers. I know I've discussed them quite a bit. They have the shower series that features, you know, one style of hops in each selection. They probably do about 8 to 10 of those a year. I had Grape Ape from Smog City. I know I discussed that in my kind of Friday, you know, matchup post. Grape Ape is one of Smog City's IPAs. They put it out a couple times a year. It's fermented with grapes, which is where you get the Grape Ape name. Really, really delicious beer. Snagged a growler of that over at Smog City. Other things I enjoyed. Headed back up to my old stomping grounds at a Library Ale House up in Santa Monica. And they had some Russian River stuff on tap. Had myself some Row 2 Hill 56 Pale Ale. Also grabbed Blind Pig because that was on. And then they also had Avery Rumpkin on tap, which I know I sent you a picture of then. Such an enjoyable beer. Just really, really does a nice job of marrying the pumpkin and rum flavors in just the right amount.
Yeah, that looked wonderful.
It was. Also had Modern Times Fruitlands. Their Fruitlands Goza. They had, that one's cherries, but they had one with apricots. So I got to enjoy that. And then last night I had Main Beer Company's A Tiny Beautiful Something. It's a pale ale. I wouldn't say it's the same level as Peeper, but nonetheless, enjoyable beer. Nice to kind of just wind down for the evening with one of those.
Yeah, the Peeper that we had when you were in New York, I don't think I've had anything from them other than that. And that was really good. So, but I don't see a lot from them down this way.
They, Aaron was telling me that the Whole Foods right over by where we were had like a bunch of their stuff here and there. Mo gets around. Lunch is a lot harder to find, but lunch is highly recommended. Dinner is their kind of like all world IPA that I still yet to try, just due to distribution issues to get out here, obviously. But yeah, Peeper was. Like, it, I mean, I like the pale ales out here, but I could drink that one all day.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's on, like, the other side of the world for me. Not California or Maine, just the Lower East Side. So next time I'm down that way, maybe I'll check it out, but it's kind of a hike.
Do not blame you there.
Got to get across town. That's no fun.
Yeah, I do not miss those days. Although around here you don't have public transportation to do it, you have to drive. So sometimes it takes me 2 hours to get to a USC game.
Yes, I have heard that about Los Angeles because I have watched SNL.
Yeah, the Californians.
R.I.P.
You know what though? I actually kind of I think the jury's out on like if they decide to bring the millennials as like a thing.
Yeah, it seems like that's what they were doing.
It seemed clever for like, I'd
a
say
sketch.
Yeah, I don't know, I'd say like 60% of it was clever, but then I think 40% wasn't, and that might have hurt the 60%.
Which sounds exactly like the Californians.
Yep.
It's like, oh, I could see this is kind of a funny sketch.
Yeah.
And then 3 years later, 12 times.
All right, so back to football. Grayson Pitt. Nobody cares outside the fact that it's a Syracuse football game. We faced Pitt, I believe it's about, what, 60 straight times now? And nobody cares. Like, not...
It's many. Yeah.
Not a single person cares. And this is, I think, the weirdest annual series around in terms of, you know, I think maybe not major college football. I think I'm sure there's a couple SEC series that probably defy logic. But this one, you have two teams that were independents for, you know, 30 plus years together and then have been in two conferences together, and they will now be forever linked, at least until realignment decides we're going to have two conferences of 40 teams apiece. We'll be forever linked as ACC mates, you know, leaving the Big East. One, Syracuse obviously being blamed for the Big East death over the other. But, yeah, it's just a really weird series that nobody, even within the fan bases, just can get behind. Maybe one day, maybe if, you know, maybe if we meet in an ACC championship game in some hypothetical universe down the road, the venom ramps up, but I'm not holding out much hope.
Yeah, I think that would require the people at the Haldron Collider to actually find like the multiverse. But the reasons for it have been discussed. Basically, Pitt and Syracuse have never been good at the same time, and they just spend, you know, history beating up on one another when the other one's bad. So I think there could be a rivalry there if both teams were like perennial bowl teams and playing for something, but it just doesn't seem like that's ever been in the cards, despite the fact that both teams have had a ton of success historically. And they recruited against each other. It's weird. And they don't like each other in basketball, where there actually is some heat for the Dame. Very bizarre that this isn't like more of a rivalry, but it's not, and you can't force it. So it is what it is. Pitt is basically having the season. I mean, what could be a really terrible, terrible year. Their starting quarterback, who I don't think is very good, but was still their starting quarterback, went down very early. Their starting running back, who is very good, was the ACC Player of the Year last year. James Conner went down after, what, two games, three games, very quickly. Actually, he only had 8 rushes on the year before he got hurt. And instead of going in the tank, they plugged in Nate Peterman, who has been way better than people would have expected. He takes a decent amount of sacks, but that's really the only knock on him. He throws... He has almost 1,000 yards already in the year. He actually has a very similar profile to Dungy. Probably not as many, not quite as a big play oriented. Doesn't make Dungy has Dungy's averaging. Actually, it's not that far off. 7.5 yards an attempt. Peterman's at 7. Peterman has a higher completion percentage, but he's probably not throwing down the field as much. They both have 9 touchdowns. They've kept interceptions down. So it's interesting that he's obviously a junior, so he's been in the system, if you can even call Pitt's current coaching situation something that has a system. But he's been at Pitt longer, so a little more experience, but he's definitely playing above where I bet most people thought. Helps that he has Tyler Boyd, who's a bona fide superstar at receiver. And then Quadri Ellison's done a really nice job filling in for Connor. He has almost 600 yards, 5 touchdowns, getting 6 yards a carry. Pitt's just done a really nice job plugging in people and rolling along and not, you know, there's no excuses for them. They've had as many bad injuries as you can imagine, and they are playing really good football.
Right. So, like, without this devolving into a commentary on coaching, and I don't think it should, at this juncture at least, Pitt is... The reason I think Pitt could be a rival... like a bona fide one, is because they're everything Syracuse should have been for the past 15 years. no, SU didn't have the talent to be, you know, a perennial 8 or 9 win team, but Pitt has managed to, you know, be a perennial 6 and 6 team that occasionally bats a little over that. I know I'm looking at 09 in particular, and maybe this year too. Pitt excels at nothing greater than anyone, but manages to do everything, you know, above average. They can have mistake-laden football, but they usually follow that up with a game that's just very sound. I mean, they've suffered their fair share of upsets in recent seasons, embarrassing ones, but they managed to bounce back. And like, while I feel like SU kind of folds under an upset, you know, Pitt, I mean, what was it, a couple years ago they lost to Youngstown State. They still made a bowl game anyway at 6-6. Yes, it was the Birmingham Bowl. You know what? I would take it at this point. There's not a respect for Pitt, but I have an appreciation for what they've been able to do, given just, I think, minimal everything, like not having an on-campus stadium, having, you know, similar-ish resources to what Syracuse has at its disposal, being in the same conference the entire time, so having the same amount of, you know, media revenues. There's just, and having more coaching upheaval than Syracuse has. I think the deck has been stacked against Pittsburgh and Syracuse in equal measure, and Pittsburgh's been able to come out still seeming like a, you know, a program worth someone's time. And we, you know, to the larger college football, this fan base, just in general from a national standpoint, has not embraced us in the same way because of our lack of success. In basketball, we have a rivalry a little bit, if only because SU has struggled to beat them here and there. If there wasn't a rivalry going into a couple of years ago, I think Tyler Ennis's shot at the buzzer helped create much more of that. It'll never be Georgetown. It'll never be UConn. Probably won't even be Villanova or St. John's. But, you know, 20 years down the line, in our new kind of reality, post-conference realignment, Pitt's going to have to be more important. That already is the case in basketball. I don't know if football is ever going to get there.
Yeah, it's strange, and it seems like a natural thing, but, you know, I think we've laid out kind of the reality of it. But I think you make an interesting point with Pitt kind of being a model, and I think some of their fans would probably say that they underachieved relative to the talent they brought in the last couple of years. But like you said, Pitt's been to 7 straight bowls. They could make it 8 after Saturday if they beat Syracuse. And Syracuse, I've seen some people cite Pitt as a cautionary tale for making coaching changes, which isn't really fair because Pitt hasn't made coaching changes. They've had coaches leave, aside from one hire, the Mike Haywood debacle, which it's hard to pin that on Pitt. You have to trust your coaches to not, you know, get into domestic abuse issues a month after they were hired. But pretty much everyone else has come into Pitt and at least had a decent amount of success. Everyone's made bowls once that they've never had like a truly terrible season. And despite the fact that they've had, 5 coaches in 6 or 7 years now, they continue to roll along. And I think, you know, you'd obviously like someone, your coaches, to hang around for more than 1 or 2 years. And going through that change process isn't easy, especially when you're revamping staffs and changing systems all the time. It's really tough on the players. But the fact that they've made so many hires in a row and they've all gone to bowl games and at least kept some momentum up, even when they turn around and leave and you're starting from square one, it says a lot about their hiring process, and now they have a new AD, so we'll see if things change. But they continually bring in good coaches, and it also proves that if there is a coaching change, it doesn't automatically doom you to resetting the clock and having to sit through, you know, multiple bowl-less years. And Syracuse saw that. I mean, Schaefer came in, and people didn't really expect him to make a bowl in year one, and he did. So I think there's a bit of a misnomer in terms of the impact of a coaching change, at least in the short term. Pitt, I don't think most schools would survive it as well as Pitt has, but I think they're not really a cautionary tale. I think that they show that you can get by with you know, if you continue to bring the best possible people in. And I don't think Narduzzi will be there forever, but he's the latest line in a number of coaches who have gone to bigger programs, but they keep on hitting the hires they do make on the head, and they're not afraid of making a hire that might be one that's attractive to a bigger school later on, because they just want the best guys in for the job.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this, and we talked about this on the site a ton. The biggest issue for Syracuse, I think, hiring anyone is, you know, trying to find the next Boeheim, trying to find the next Pasqualoni or McPherson. There's just, for some reason, Syracuse feels like they're not a, at the same, fans both feel like they're not a destination job, but also shouldn't be hiring someone who's going to leave in 4 years. And, you know, that's how you get all the venom toward Marone on his way out. I just think that, you know, you're right. Pitt has managed to create continuity through a lack of it by just hiring guys who they knew would be successful, and whether it was at Pitt or somewhere else, they would at least create enough success to be 6-6. Syracuse, on the other hand, you know, you have a continuity hire with Schaefer, who it seemed like that worked going into 2013, but then since then, we've seen, you know, the hallmarks of a non-continuity hire. I guess to me, I think that it might be time to take a look at Pitt's strategy and say, you know, this, maybe this isn't so bad. Maybe this, I mean, again, not calling for Schaefer to be fired this year. I really hope that he turns this thing around. But more just saying, like, maybe it's time for the university, though, to reevaluate how it makes these football hires, given that other schools with similar situations have been able to succeed with a very different strategy. And I do think, like you said, I think Narduzzi spends 3 or 4 years there, and I'm sure he's lined up for probably the Michigan State job whenever, you know, D'Antonio decides to head down to SEC or something.
Yeah, it's just, there's no reason to be afraid of the success if you're Syracuse. Like, and I think maybe we won't have that now. We have a new AD who is yet to make a big hire, who's, you know, seems to be taking a very patient approach, which he should. But in the world, in a world where Scott Schaefer doesn't work out, which I'm not, you know, outright projecting or hoping for or anything, I hope Schaefer, you know, pulls a couple of rabbits out of his hat and we can get to a bowl, and beating Pitt this weekend would kind of offset one of the last two losses. Like, as bad as losing to USF or UVA is, beating Pitt's just as good in the other direction. So, you know, the year is far from lost. We're 3-3, despite some of my tweets after that game. But I think in a world where Syracuse does have to make a hire, like, being afraid of success is silly. And, like, you coaches move. That just happens in the sport. I think just the fact that we had Pasqualoni for so long kind of blindsided us to Marone leaving and kind of the shifting grounds of where college football coaching is. Guys just don't sit around the same job forever. There's literally one guy in college football who is anywhere close to being what Boeheim is or Coach Tay is, and that's Bill Snyder. And Bill Snyder is great, but he's also very much of, you know, he's obviously around Boeheim's age, probably even older. He's of a past generation. Now people are going up the ladder, trying their hand at the NFL, you know, making the runs at the SEC or the Big Ten jobs. Like, it's just a reality. Everyone's going to try to go to that next step. And I don't blame anyone for doing that. So instead of trying to hire a coach who you think, for whatever reason, I don't know, isn't good enough to leave or something, just go get the best guy. And if he leaves, it's probably for good reason. It probably means that he was good where he was. So, hopefully, whenever Syracuse has to make another hire, they aren't, like, afraid of their own shadow and just go and get the best guy available instead of worrying about, you know, will this guy like his home in Manlius and the school system? Like, just go get the guy who's going to win the most. And if he wins too much and he goes to take the job at Ole Miss, you know, you have a guy that was good enough where an SEC school went and poached him. So go get another one.
Absolutely. And yeah, again, not to, I think both of us want to make that clear that we're not calling for any sort of firing or new hire or anything like that. We're more just pointing out that there's a strategy in place at Pitt that if things happen at SU, that that we have alternatives to the strategy that, you know, we've put in place up until this point. And we'll just leave it at that. Dan, I guess we got about 10 minutes left. What do you see happening in Saturday's game? I know we haven't really, I know you got to dig down a little bit into kind of some of the playmakers for Pitt. What do you see happening on Saturday and kind of how and why?
Well, Pitt's had our number for years now. I don't think that changes. I think they're just more stable in what they do, even with the injuries. I think Tyler Boyd is a huge playmaker. And we've had some complaints about Syracuse using their own playmakers. Tyler Boyd's a good one to point at in terms of like what we should be doing with Steve Ishmael. He has a 39% target rate. He catches the ball over 80% of the time. He's getting almost 10 yards a catch. He has 50 targets already this year through six games, which is, you know, eight or nine a game. That's where Syracuse should be with Irv, with Steve Ishmael, with the best players on the team. Unfortunately, I don't see anything changing. Tyler Boyd's been very good against Syracuse in his career. I'll pull up the stats in a second. I do think it'll be close. I don't think Pitt will blow us out. I think it probably helps that the two staffs are pretty familiar with one another, so I expect it to be a pretty close game. I think Pitt will pull it out by a touchdown, maybe less. I think it'll go into the fourth quarter like these last couple games have gone. Unfortunately, I see the Panthers winning. But I do think it'll probably be frustrating based on four straight losses, but I think in a vacuum, it won't be a bad performance by Syracuse. I just think that Tyler Boyd is going to be the X factor for Pitt, as he so often is. I'm pulling up his game log now, because I remember he absolutely torched us in one of these last couple games. Against Syracuse last year, he had seven catches for 126 yards and a touchdown. And 2 years ago, he had 10 catches for 82 yards in that really low-scoring 17-16 game.
Yeah, I could see that. I just think that the Syracuse defense is just too much, trending toward the hot garbage on the hot garbage scale of 1 to 10 to keep it a low score. I think that Syracuse can hang with Pitt offensively, but I think the defense just gets outpaced after a while. I was worried last week. You know, Pitt was able to beat Georgia Tech. Peterman played very, very well at quarterback. He's not a world beater, like you alluded to. He's just a really efficient guy who, I wouldn't call him a game manager. He makes plays, but he knows how to utilize the tools that they have out there, and namely Tyler Boyd, who obviously is one of the better receivers in the conference. I think as much as I want to see Syracuse pull this upset, as much as I think they can, and to be honest, there isn't a week that goes by that, I mean, Syracuse could have won every game they played this year. They decided not to against a couple teams, but Syracuse has been able to win games this year, and it's more than we could say for last season, and that's progress. But I do think that between Pitt having our number, between us not being able to stop any opposing offense of late, and that might put too much on Dungy, I think we're going to lose a 34-26 game that makes me very angry and results in a very very salty offensive play calling breakdown article next week.
Yeah, we'll see. I think unfortunately Narduzzi hasn't wasted too much time in installing the defense that became so feared at Michigan State. It's obviously not quite that good at Pitt, but the numbers bear out pretty well for them. So it'll be interesting to see how Tim Lester responds. Obviously, he has a Diane Schaefer who comes from a very similar background, so maybe he can get some insight there. But Pitt's defense is no joke, especially against the pass. They give up. You can get them on the big play occasionally, but overall, they've been defending the pass incredibly well. The run has been a little more, they've been a little more susceptible to the run. Their advanced metrics aren't all that great there, but I think part of that is playing Iowa, which is not good for teams this year. Iowa is actually really good, so I'll be interested to see how the offense responds. It's a really good test for Syracuse, and if Lester can go score some points, even if it's a loss, if Syracuse can move the ball as well as they have in weeks past and it would drop like 35 on Pitt, I think that'd be a really good sign. Hopefully the defense didn't keep up their end, although I don't have a ton of faith in them based on the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I would like to see, and obviously we won't know this until closer to kickoff. I'd like to see if Rodney Williams comes back. I think that that could be a huge, uptick in production. I think as long as Wiggum's out there, and again, I'm not going to hammer the kid too much, but he's not really good at covering anybody, and I wouldn't mind giving somebody else a shot at this point. But yeah, I think if Rodney Williams comes back, that might help a little over the top. I know we've gotten just completely roasted. With him and in and out of the lineup, but at least he would make things a little bit better. We didn't discuss yet, might as well briefly. Dungy's favorite target, Ben Lewis, will not be playing in this game. If everyone remembers, in the second half last week, he seemed to get hit, pretty hard in the was it elbow or shoulder? Dan, do you remember?
I can't remember the specific play, but we have harped on Ben Lewis and carries, but overall Ben Lewis is a really useful player, so it's not great news for SU.
No, and I think I got into this in the injury report article. I think the one caveat here is that this could give Dante Strickland a lot more burn, which I think could be a very, very good thing for this team. He's been dynamic, he's played well. It's just that he hasn't gotten more than a few chances, and I'd like to see what he can do. I know Kendall Moore is also doubtful. We've talked about him as well. Moore is one of the better blockers on the team, obviously, because he's a converted offensive lineman. I think that all the issues that Lester and Trudeau were alluding to in terms of blocking schemes, that extra blitzer, something that the Moore could potentially help pick up if we're not going to use the tight end in the passing game, and we didn't last week. Might as well have him out there as a blocker, and I think he's a big step up from Paris in that regard. So, doubtful means he's probably not going to play, but I can hold out hope that at least the progress from out to doubtful means that if he's not in this week, that maybe he's back next week.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have all hands on deck as we hit the meat of this really tough ACC stretch that we're about to go into.
Yep, and that's why this game is so critical, because after this, in some order, we have Florida State, Clemson, and Louisville in a row.
Not great, Bob.
No, not great at all. All right. Yeah, so I guess we'll leave it at that. Give everybody a couple minutes back of their days if they were banking on this being, hour or so. Dan, thanks as always for joining.
Yes, hopefully we will have more positive Syracuse and Mets things to report next week.
Very much so. Everyone, thanks for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. I'm John. That was Dan. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe, whatever, on Blog Talk and on iTunes. And go Orange and the Mets.
Go Orange, go Mets.